playback on RT Radio 1. Sponsored by the all-new Irish Times Weekend. With new writers like Marion Keyes and Sean Moncrief, your weekend's in good hands.
There are few people who out-Marty Marty Morrissey for enthusiasm.
And Limerick can't get the grips with Daniel Carney.
But John Milan makes a pretty good fist of it.
Up in Croke Park last year, he's buzzing, he's popping up everywhere. He's on the ball again.
It's all the rebels, as Daniel Carney.
John Milan was co-commentating with Marty Morrissey on Sunday at the Gaelic Grounds in Limerick for the Cork-Limerick game in the Senior Hurling Championships.
He's kind of in third gear.
Oh, Marty, that was a sensational score and I can't describe it. In these testing conditions, the score, he three Limerick lads around him, he moved to the right, he moved to the left, and over his shoulder put the ball over the bar, and Cork go a point ahead.
If he was dancing with the stars, he'd get 10 from Brian Redmond as the ball comes in to Graham Mulcahy, and that is picked over the crossbar. Cork 118, Limerick 114, Horgan made the goal and he cracked it past Nicky Quaid.
Yeah, proving like every good assassin does. He went up, flicked the ball, got inside, and there was only one place that was going, and that was the back of the Limerick net. And it's most certainly game on now, and Limerick are going to have to open, Marty.
Here comes Keane Lynch, heading towards the 20-metre line. He's there for the stop. The win during the league and indeed during the Allianz League.
They're having this relaxed attitude, you know, as if it's going to happen, but you've got to go and make it happen, Marty.
Long ball up, comes round to Alan Callaghan. Dancing a kick.
John Milan with Marty Morrissey on Sunday Sport, and the music was from Happy Jack by The Who, as heard on The South Wind Blows. Marty's reference to Dancing with the Stars puts you in mind of the most requested interview to playback at rte.ie this week.
Now, I was watching Britain's Got Talent over the weekend and I was intrigued by one of the acts. And
it was that between Ray Darcy and Dr. Peter Lovett, otherwise known as Dr. Dance.
He's a psychologist and a lecturer. So why was he on Britain's Got Talent? Well, Peter's on the line to tell us. How are you doing, Peter?
I'm good, thanks. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Well done on Britain's Got Talent. So will you explain what you're doing on Britain's Got Talent to people?
Well, I wanted to give a lecture. I wanted to be the first person to give a lecture on Britain's Got Talent.
Right.
And I wanted to tell people all about the science of dancing.
So what's the neurophysiology of dancing?
Well, we know that dancing has these amazing impacts. We know that dance impacts people in four ways. It impacts their social interaction. It has an impact on their thinking and problem solving. It impacts on their brain, on the physiology of the brain. And also it activates the emotional centers in the body and the mind. So we get this, or the four points of the psychological compass, the social, cognitive, the physical and the emotional, are all activated during dancing.
I have the song that you played, well, that you spoke around or shouted over on Britain's Got Talent. Do you want to talk our audience through a bit? What should they be doing if they were standing up? Obviously, don't do this if you're in a car.
But no, even in a car, you can do this.
Okay.
I'll talk you through it.
Well, will I just play it from the start, Boogie Wonderland?
You just play it and we'll talk through it.
Okay, go for it.
Okay. So what we know is that there's something called sensory motor coupling. When we hear stuff coming in through our ears, it activates the motor areas of our brain, and that gives us an urge to move. So what I want you to do is to think about which parts of your body might move to this groove. Now, this is called the psychology of the groove. It might be in your thighs, in your tummy, in your chest, or your head that starts moving. And just let that urge start to express itself larger and larger and larger. Now, if you're driving, don't make it very large at all. If you're not driving, just stand up and feel that groove and have it all come through from that center. What we know is that when people start dancing together, they get happy. They bond together as a social group. They show even more pro-social behaviour. If you're at work, it's a wonderful thing to all dance together. But just let your body go. There's no right and wrong way to dance. Just feel that groove.
Dr. Peter Lovett, Dr. Dance, with Ray Darcy. This is the new single from the Divine Comedy, Norman and Norma.
Norman and Norma got married in Cromer, April 1983. It could have been warmer, but Norman and Norma were happy as they'd ever been. They flew to Mallorca and swam in the water. It felt just like having a bath. She said, oh, children have gone and they're both at a bit of a loss. They've tried salsa classes and growing tomatoes, but nothing is getting them off. Then one day in Clacton there's a reenactment of Normans and Saxons, and this gets their juices flowing. Before long they're going and fighting like it's 1066. And she says, oh, Norman, it's never ever felt like this before. And oh, Norman, I've never really known such bliss before. Oh, no, Norman.
The Divine Comedy's Norman and Norma, as heard on Late Date with Cathal Murray, and one of this week's RTE Radio 1 Recommends tracks. Ryan Tuberty had Jenny McIntaggart on. She has epilepsy. She talked about her incredible surgery, but before that, she explained to Ryan what would trigger her seizures.
Loud noises, so audio sensitive. And that would mean a beep of a car or something just startling me. But towards the end, as time went on, those noises could be as light as a spoon dropping.
No. And material? Would that be an issue for your clothes and things
fabrics
like that?
Fabrics on my skin, yes. Different fabrics on my skin. It would seem to aggravate it even more, even though that makes no sense.
Well, it does make sense in if it triggers it. That's what it is.
I basically had to dress for seizures. When I was getting dressed in the morning, I would have to consider, oh, if I have a seizure later on today, will this affect it?
And what were the seizures doing in terms of your day-to-day and how you had to plan? You say, like, getting dressed is one thing. What else were you having to worry about if you were going to a restaurant or going to a shop or anything like that?
Everything. I was constantly accompanied by somebody, even walking around at home. I mean, on a good day, I could go up and have my meals in the kitchen with everybody else. But normally, I would eat in my room.
It seems like very strange that, or it's like it's really difficult to kind of function in the normal world, let's call it that.
Absolutely. I mean, I was thrust into this strange reality.
How did you get through? Like, if there's a bang, whether it's, as you say, it's the car horn or a spoon falling or certain fabric you might wear, how do you keep going?
I think anything can become normal once it happens consistently. So you've no choice really, just to plow through it.
And what did you do in terms of medicals? What were you looking for support-wise, or what were you getting?
My neurologist, Professor Norman Delante, he looked after it for, say, 16 years, and it was exhausting, trial and error of drugs. So you're going up on one drug, coming down on another, constantly hoping that one of them would work.
Yeah, and nothing at that. For a long time, nothing was working, obviously.
From 22 to 33, nothing.
Well, let me ask you about then trying to stop it or put an end to it as much as he could, and that's when brain surgery seemed to be an option or coming on the agenda. Do you want to tell me about that? And
absolutely. I mean, with epilepsy, people use this word battle against epilepsy, but it doesn't feel, or bravery going for surgery, but it doesn't feel like a battle at all. Rather, it feels quite passive. You're just trying to resist it. So I was brought into the epilepsy monitoring unit in Beaumont. Mm-hmm. Three times. For the first two, it was external monitoring where electrodes are placed on your head. But for the third one, when I was approached about the idea of surgery, it was invasive monitoring.
Right.
So that involved going for my first craniotomy, which is nearly a year ago. It was 31st May last year.
Yes.
So for that one, you have a grid placed on the surface of your brain, and then you're brought to the epilepsy monitoring unit. And they use any methods to provoke a seizure. So that would mean sleep deprivation, loud noises for me, everything.
you're kind of going through that and feeling, right, I need to get into proper surgery at that point then, is that right?
Yeah, the third one was a pre-surgical evaluation. I knew from the start that this could end in full surgery.
Yeah.
When I say full surgery, I mean removing the problem area from the brain.
So that's a piece of your brain?
Absolutely.
Right, tell me about that then.
Now in the laboratory, thank God.
We'll get there in a second, I'm sure. But did you, when they said that to you, when they were chatting away what they were going to do to you, for you and with you, and they said, we're going to take a little piece of your brain out, did you have any quandaries about that or worries about that?
I think it's only natural to be nervous. You're kind of thrust into this unknown.
Yeah.
But I had a year in between the monitoring unit and the actual surgery.
Yeah.
So I became obsessed when I was first approached about it. And I was Googling everything, coming across these medical terms that I hadn't a clue what they were.
Yeah.
So Googling them, then going back, I was absolutely a woman possessed.
I bet.
But by the time it came around, I was really, really calm because I had nearly exhausted myself from doing all the research.
All right, well, let me ask you then, how did the operation go?
Fantastic.
Great.
Absolutely fantastic. I can't praise the staff of Bowman enough. They make the whole process so much easier. The neurosurgeon, Mr. Donico O'Brien, fantastic. Yeah. I mean, to have the opportunity to have this man work with you is basically like they're handing you a winning lottery ticket. All you have to do is cash it in.
What happened then afterwards? How quick was the notice? Was it to notice what had happened?
I went 10 days seizure-free completely, which was unheard of for me previously. And then after that, I would have slight seizures where it would be a 4 or 5 second daze where you're just looking at something and you've kind of lost concentration of what's going on around you. But then they've basically disappeared.
Yeah. So that's great. So you're out the other side, ultimately.
Absolutely. Life-changing.
Life-changing.
Absolutely life-changing.
The bit of your brain now, you have me interested now. Where it's in a lab somewhere, is it?
It is.
It sounds like something out of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. Is it?
It is, yeah.
Sitting there in a bubbling formaldehyde. So
won't be going back in. Anyway.
Are they going to examine it and use it for science?
Research.
They
research
are.
Process, yes.
Right, so they knew exactly which part to take out and to...
That's what the grid is about.
Fascinating.
Locating, absolutely pinpointing.
Wow.
Where the problem area is, so they can go in and just scoop it out like a piece of ice cream.
Amazing. Nicely put.
Jenny McIntaggart with Ryan Tuberty on Tuesday. The day before that was World Bee Day, and to mark it, Mooney Goes Wild had a bee special. Terry Flanagan met a man named Lorcan for the programme.
It started last June. I was upstairs having a shower, standing in my bath, my old June mixer taps. And I heard it. I said, Jesus, someone cutting the grass outside with a streamer. So anyway, I got out of the bath and I dried myself off and there was no more taps running. And this was still buzzing. And I said, Jesus, I wonder, it sounds as if there's something coming from under the bath. So I had this gut feeling that I'd go into the bedroom, the adjacent bedroom, and look in. And boy, when I opened the door, there was hundreds of them in there.
Hundreds of bees?
Yeah.
Flying around?
Hundreds of bees flying around. I just had a towel around me to cover me privates and I had to go over because I could see them on the window and a lot of them seemed to look dead on the windowsill. And I said, Jesus, I wonder has the queen bee got in here because there's that many of them. And that frightened me because I didn't want a whole hive of bees in the bedroom, you know. So I went over and I gingerly opened the window slowly and I withdrew from the room and consequently they did, a lot of them, most of them went out and they come in where I showed you out the back there and they've been in there under the bath ever since.
Okay. Gordon, what do you think?
Yeah.
You're the expert, I should say that first of all.
Well, I'm the local beekeeper as such. It was a swarm that found this cavity in the wall at Tour Lakin and they swarmed into it last June and I would say that it was already picked at that stage because bees usually find the place that they want first and then they swarmed into it. So it was a swarm that went into it.
And what you're going to do is you're going to remove them in the next week or two.
I hopefully move them shortly now because they're starting to take off now. Well, I don't mean take off, but they're actually getting stronger now and they could swarm again out of that and create a nuisance within the community, like, you know.
Because we're in a built-up area here.
That's it, yeah.
And it's not really ideal, is it?
It's not, but bees don't see it that way, you know.
Yeah.
They just see it as a cavity. They don't care where they go as long as it fits their purpose, you know.
Okay.
When there's kids around, there's always that fear, like, somebody could get stung, like. So you have to think of your neighbours as well, like, you know.
Okay, well, lead us on. Dorkin, on you go.
Come on up.
Go on, on you go first.
Three big men shouldn't be afraid of bees anyway.
Yeah, well, maybe you two shouldn't be, but... I'll tell you now when we get
in. Let's tread softly. Beat with
WBH, I'll say. Okay, so we're just going into the bedroom.
Yep.
And
they're over here in the corner.
Oh, I see them. Yeah, yeah. I can hear them. They're just removing some of the some dead ones there on the floor. I see. Yeah.
Yeah, they're quite lost. You see, they've come out.
Now, do you see where I had that hole with the tissue paper in?
Yes. Yeah.
I think that's how they got into the room here after coming in under the bath. And there's hundreds in here.
Is it a difficult job?
It's not a difficult job, but it's a kind of a delicate job. You have to take it with a bit of care because, as you obviously know, there's wild comb in there. And there's eggs in it, there's honey in it. The queen is there somewhere. So they have to, you have to take it out with very, you have to be very, very careful. There is an apparatus that we use. It's a converted hoover with low suction power because if it's high, it'll damage their wings. And it sucks them up, puts them in, it goes into a nuke box, which is a small hive, sucks them in. You sometimes you may find the queen when you're doing this and you put her in a cage to protect her. But that just purely down to luck. You could miss her, you could get her, you could be lucky. Cut out the combs, put them into a hive and put the bees back into the hive. And do that at night when they're all in, so you don't miss any.
And what will you do with them?
They'll go into a conventional hive then, well, a national hive or commercial hive, and try to get them off the wild combs onto frames. Right. So we can manage them then and hopefully get a surplus of honey off them then, maybe, you know. But at least when you have them in a hive, you can manage them better. You can't manage them when they're like this in their wild state.
Yeah.
Because they mix the comb with the eggs and the brood. You know what I mean? But they're in their wild state there and they're happy enough, they would stay there. That's the ideal. That's their natural environment where they are now.
Yeah.
And they're happy to be there. It just means as a beekeeper, you can't manage them.
Right, okay. So you don't see this as a big job then?
No, that's just an occupational hazard.
Okay, well, I wish you the best of luck.
No problem.
From the Mooney Goes Wild Bee Special from Monday night. John Bowman's Sunday morning programme had a recording this week of the singer John McCormack, as you've never heard him before, perhaps.
This is the young 8-year-old Cyril McCormack singing. The pianist, John McCormack. And at the conclusion, the pianist named the date. It's a long, long way to Tipperary, and my
heart right there. Made on the 31st of March 1915.
Cyril McCormack, son of the singer John, being accompanied by his father on the piano. That was from John Bowman's programme on Sunday morning. On Sunday night, the poetry programme had a poem from a child's eye point of view.
This poem is called Suppose. Suppose. Suppose, just supposing your mother, say, had been in hospital for a long time and then she came home. And on the same day, naturally, there was a free movie at the school. And not only a free movie, but a cowboy with Roy Rogers and free Coca-Cola and silver badges and wild talk about ice cream you didn't really believe. Supposing. Supposing you came home at lunchtime and found her in her usual chair, looking thin and worn, and you got a fright, because you hadn't been allowed to see her while she was sick. But there she was now, your mother, home again. And supposing she held out her arms and began to cry, and you reluctantly moved closer, and she held on to you as if she was drowning. And suppose you only felt then the sting of her loss. And even though she said you could take the day off and the two of you could talk together in the old way by the fire, your head on her lap, you left her there with that shrill old busybody Mrs. Keane for company while you ran to the school and dived into the excitement. I'm just wondering, how long do you think you should carry this with you before you could forgive yourself?
Ron Carey from the poetry programme on Sunday night on Radio 1. And earlier that day on 2FM, Anton Savage was on with Dave Fanning talking about some of the offbeat news stories of the week.
A family in Bendigo in Victoria in Australia, and I apologise to the residents of Bendigo, if that's not how you pronounce it. It's a kind of a heartwarming story. It was a family who were kind of having tough times. The father is quoted in the story that tells what happens by saying, "We've come on some tough times, so it's really good because we've been struggling financially. It couldn't be better timing, really." And what happened is they went out for a walk, taking their dog for a walk, and their daughter, the daughter of the man quoted, kicked something hard lying on the ground. She, quoting the father again, he said, "I actually walked right past it, but my daughter pretty much kicked it as she was walking." She then goes, "Dad, is this gold?" I said, "I think it might be." Turns out he was right. His daughter kicked a 624-gram gold nugget, which was just lying on the ground. Now, to put that in old money, that's a pound and a quarter-ish of pure gold.
Wow.
The street value, $35,000.
Anton Savage with Dave Fanning on 2FM. And also on 2FM, Africa and Carl were discussing the latest entertainment news.
He lost 3 million subscribers in the space of 3 days.
Okay.
Which is
the story was huge. An online row between YouTubers who produce makeup videos.
And his kind of apology video was one of the top 10 most disliked videos last week, yeah.
Another makeup YouTuber, by the way, Jeffree Star, got involved. Controversy follows him around.
How is there so many YouTube? Like, is he a makeup YouTuber as well?
He is, yeah.
Oh, for God's sake.
Well, how many adventure YouTubers are there, Carl?
True.
How many climbing mountains YouTubers are there?
Listen,
how many sunset YouTubers are there?
There's a lot of mountains to be climbed.
Exactly. Well, there's a lot of makeup to be tried. Do you know what I mean? So let's, you know, people are into different things.
Keep your little opinion to yourself there, yeah.
So, Jeffree Star.
Africa and Carl on 2FM. Sorry, I'll try that again.
20 minutes past 7 o'clock. It's Africa and Carl in with you until 10 this morning. How are you?
You were very, very specific about the Africa and Carl.
I have to enunciate. Now.
After someone thought you were saying African Carl.
African Carl, yeah. I always have to enunciate. It's either Carl in Africa or Africa and Carl. We have to enunciate these things.
This is from Simply Folk.
So it's a musical somersaults there from the Irish-Norwegian band The Snowflake Trio.
Ruth Smith from Simply Folk on Radio 1 on Sunday night. On Friday night on Radio 1, Seascapes came across something you don't usually hear about, dolphin attacks.
Galway lifeboat, this is Galway Boathouse, Galway Boathouse.
Lorna Siggins was with the women of the Galway lifeboat.
Galway Boathouse, Galway Lifeboat on 3-1, go ahead, over.
I'm thinking back over the call-outs, a memorable one for lots of reasons was the dolphin attack in Sawtill. That particular evening, there was four of us down the lifeboat station servicing life jackets, so we were there ready to go. Very unusual call out. There's not much training you do in the Orna Lifeboat College in England that trains you for dealing with dolphin attacks. So I suppose we headed out to that call out, kind of trying to figure out what was going to happen when we got there. Thankfully, it wasn't as dramatic as we thought, and we all learned a bit from it, and everybody was fine after that. There was no swimmers hurt, but I suppose that stands out as one of the most unusual call-outs I've been on since I started there. The dolphin himself was around for a little while after the swimmers came out. He eventually left the area, so thankfully there wasn't a repeat occurrence. Unfortunately, a lot of the stuff we do, it involves the river. The River Corrib is one of the fastest flowing in Europe, so unfortunately we end up on call-outs around the river, so that's a tough part of it.
Yeah, we have a big problem here with, unfortunately, suicide, and we have one of the fastest flowing rivers in Europe here, and unfortunately we have quite a number that go in every year, and this year has been no different. So, you know, it has been very hard on the crew, and it's only March, so, you know, we've had some traumatic call-outs in the last few months, but that's part of the job, and we deal with it as best we can, and we do get professional advice too from time to time if we need it, but we do the best we can. And we also have very good support from University Hospital. One of the psychiatrists there actually gives us backup when we need it, and she has made herself available to us, so it's invaluable, you know, because obviously some people do bring it home with them, and I'd be lying if I said otherwise, you know. And you bring these people home, you know, and you might see them for a week or two before you go to sleep at night, and then eventually it'll fade away. But sometimes you need the extra professional telescope, yeah, putting a light on it and just, you know, reaffirming that this is all very normal, you know, because a lot of the crew here would not have a medical background, and they're in, you know, they could be engineers, teachers, whatever, and they, you know, I think it could be harder on them.
The women of the Galway Lifeboat talking to Lorna Siggins on Seascapes on Friday night on Radio 1. Over on Lyric FM on Sunday night, the actor and writer Mark Doherty was choosing the music for John Kelly. This was his first choice. Waltz for Debbie, sung by The Real Group.
Somewhere in her own little head. One day, all
chickles, they will cry as they whisper goodbye. They will miss her, I fear, but then so will the
The Real Group, with Waltz for Debbie from Mystery Train with John Kelly on Lyric FM on Sunday evening. On Monday evening on Radio 1 on Arena, the arts programme, Sean Rocks got to learn how soundtracks for movies are developed. In studio were film director Paddy Branagh and film composer Stephen Renix.
What happened, I suppose, in terms of that sort of corrupted property market in a way, or dysfunctional property market, that had been...
They worked together on the film Rosie, which was about a Dublin family which had been made homeless.
Let's actually listen to the opening of the film, because I know you can tell me the specifics about how this scene worked, how you worked on the mix of the final edit of the film and then the music that Stephen put to it. It's Sarah Green was playing the character of Rosie. She's the mother. Mo Dunford was the father. And it was three or four children they had?
The four children.
Four children, right. Well, you'll hear the Sarah Green character, Rosie, and she's in the process. It's early in the day, so she has to work out, where are we going to stay tonight?
Hiya, yeah, I'm looking for a room. A family room. No, for a week, just, I'd say. Hiya, I'm looking for a room. For a few nights. A family room. It's Dublin City Council. The council credit card, you're on a list of hotels it was given. I'm looking for a room for a few nights. There's six of us. I got your number from a list I was given and... Okay, thanks anyway. Hiya, I'm looking for a room for a few nights. A family room? That's right, yeah, city council credit card. Even for a night, just?
And there we have the opening sequence in the film Rosie, and the composer of that score, Stephen Renix, along with the director of the film, Paddy Branagh, are both with me in studio this evening. And I suppose the two real kind of elements to the music that struck me when I was listening to it there, Stephen, is first of all, is that if it was an Uilleann pipe, it'd be a drone. It's that long chord that, you know, the kind of as if the bow on the violin or whatever string this is, as if this is going on forever. Yeah. It's the longest bow in the universe. And, you know, that builds. So that's kind of giving this tension. But then this, the timing in of those little piano phrases. Would you be working specifically with a pretty much a finished article in terms of what Paddy gave you? This is where the dialogue is. I can fit a little bit of music there.
Yeah, it would have been up to
it. So you'd be coming to it quite late in the process.
Well, late. There's a thing now that's called soft lock. There used to be locked pictures, but now it's soft lock, which means they're not really locked. So I don't know why they say locked at all. It means you can always change, you know, you can change. And I don't think that stuff... I don't think around there changed much, but I would have written it to give space around those lines. But it didn't mean the nature of the piece was such that you could probably, when you come to the mix, you could have moved them around a little bit. But I know you're not keen on that. You like to have as much of that stuff done. But no, Paddy and I would talk a lot about this. I think probably more than, I suppose, almost anybody else I would work with.
And would you be talking? I mean, would you be talking at the script stage? How soon would that talking start?
No, I saw a fairly finished cut. I think I was one of the first people to see it, and I remember I saw it on a Wednesday. I had just come off The Little Stranger, which was Lenny's most recent film, and it was a Wednesday morning, and I went into a screening room at the back of Screen Scene. And it's hard, you know, you come in from daylight or whatever, and I watched it. And at the end of it, I said, I'd asked them not to turn the lights on for a couple of minutes because I kind of needed to compose myself.
And was that the theme and the story that's told?
It was just utterly moving. Yeah. Because, look, I have four kids. I'm very aware of how close that situation is to any of us. I mean, I, you know, because, and I suppose it's the nature of what Paddy and I do. If we're not working, we're not earning, we're not, you know, there's all that kind of thing. And you realise actually how a series of seemingly small things could lead to being in a situation where you just don't have cash. And if you're in a situation where you don't have the privilege that I would have or a support system or whatever, you're in real trouble. And then the system is kind of designed to not really help you. It's like if you do everything that's possible and everything lines up for you, then you might be okay. But otherwise, it's very difficult. So yes, I was very moved by it.
And I mean, that piano theme is one that's used, and that long chordal thing, that kind of drone that I'm calling it. I don't like the word drone because it's not a droney sound.
It sort of works. It's used throughout the film. It's a pad or whatever, and it kind of works as a sort of suspended thing. It sort of underlines a sort of sense of suspension on something.
It has an inbuilt tension.
It does. Yeah,
you're waiting for something to happen.
And the film is quite tense, actually. You know, in some ways it has sort of, I mean, it's not a thriller, obviously, but it has some sort of a kind of unrelenting rising tension.
Well, I suppose part of what you're looking at is, are they going to be housed? Are they going to be stuck in this situation forever? How are they going to resolve this? Yeah.
Can she keep her family together? You know, can she hold her family together?
Film director Paddy Branagh and film composer Stephen Renix with Sean Rocks on Arena on Radio 1. On Liveline, Taran talked to Joe about a bizarre letter.
It says, how to vote the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, an open letter from the dead.
That's right, yeah. And it did come along with an official leaflet for a particular candidate as well.
Okay, and who is this open letter from the dead? Who is it from?
Well, my copy that I was given has a signature of Father Sweeney on it, but other people I've spoken to who live in the town, who live in Remelton, have said that theirs was unsigned.
But this is Father Desmond Sweeney in Remelton?
I think so, yeah.
Okay, and can you explain it to our listeners? What does he mean, an open letter from the dead? Who's dead? Who's relatives?
So it appears to be a kind of generic letter where he's speaking on behalf of all of our dead relatives. He particularly stipulates your parents and grandparents would like to speak a few words with you.
This is the dead writing to their relatives. It doesn't say what age their relatives are. I presume all their relatives. How could you have consented to remove from your constitution the Eighth Amendment? It was like leaving, as you say, a pet lamb in the middle of a forest to be mangled and devoured by a pack of wild animals.
Yeah, and then he also specifically talks about children being murdered, deliberate killing of children. And, I mean, this didn't come in an envelope or anything, and it was my small child who picked these up, and she started reading them. Mm-hmm. And she was quite distressed at first when it said an open letter from the dead. And then I explained to her that it was written by an anti-choice person, and she was kind of familiar with the stuff that they had done during repeal referendum. So I just explained to her, but it was pretty distressing for her at first.
Did she read the line where it says, "Remember, the day is near at hand when your term on earth will come to an end and you will join us, your loved ones gone before you again"?
I don't think she got that far, but I think the bit where it says that if we don't vote for a anti-choice candidate,
there's a name
in the election,
candidate and a name party. Yeah.
Yeah, where it says if we don't vote for that person, then we won't be able to look our loved ones in the face when we meet them in heaven. It's just terrible emotional blackmail.
And as for those who do arrive here, i.e. heaven, where all the relatives are, with blood on their hands, Jesus will deal with them. In fact, he has already done so. He has already pronounced his verdict. It's recorded in the Gospels. Look it up. And then it's a big long PS asking you to vote for a named candidate in a named political party. John Mackett here. John, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
John is editor of the Tyrconnell Tribune. And you printed this letter, did you?
Of course, I print all Father Sweeney's letters for the past 30 years because he's been one of the strongest advocates for the protection of the unborn, and this is not the first time he has printed this type of letter because he's dealing specifically within the terms of the Gospels, and it just so happens that in these instances this point of view happens to coincide with those of a particular political party.
And yourself, obviously.
And myself, obviously. Like, I don't know if any other newspaper has printed these letters, but I'm not in the area.
Well, do you really think a serious newspaper would print an open letter from the dead?
I don't see why not.
Well, hang on, first of all, just not being facetious, there's no postal system. And two, the dead can't write, as far as we know.
You see, this is a letter where he's put himself in that position as a very holy, spiritual, charismatic figure of 86 years of age. We feel we have an obligation to print those letters, because by ignoring them and putting them in the bin, we'd be practicing the, you know, censorship.
And do you print every letter you get?
No, we don't.
So you do ignore some letters and put them in the bin?
Like, if they're libel.
Yeah, well, of course. I presume you're not getting letters, libelous letters, by the truckload, are you?
We get too many of them. Yeah. Where named individuals accused of certain actions that are not corroborated.
Taran, 51551. Taran, what do you think of what John is saying? He's a priest and he's entitled to his opinion, and he's entitled to advocate people vote whatever. Well, he's advocating not just a particular party, but a particular individual.
Of course, we're all entitled as individuals to be able to give our opinion. I don't have any problem with Father Sweeney doing that. I do think that it is offensive and patronising that he's claiming to speak for everybody's dead relatives. If I wrote a letter from a dead figure, would you publish that in your newspaper?
Well, you're putting us into a position to make a judgment without knowing what you're going to write. We'll have to get the letter and read
it. Well, if it was non-libelous, but I was claiming to be from dead figures in history, speaking on their behalf,
I would have to make that call. We have published those type of letters.
We're not people.
We're not going to be judgmental about something that we haven't.
Hang on, John. Now, you haven't published any other letters from dead people.
We have published letters over the last 30 years.
Not from dead people.
I think we have, yeah.
People claiming to be a dead person.
I think Father Sweeney has already published letters from the dead in previous Eighth Amendment campaigns.
From Liveline with Joe Duffy, the lyric feature on Lyric FM was A Radical Life, a history of the Irish writer Maria Edgeworth, who predated Jane Austen and produced similar work.
Mrs. Stanhope, a well-bred woman, accomplished in that branch of knowledge which is called the art of rising in the world, had, with but a small fortune, contrived to live in the highest company. She prided herself upon having established half a dozen nieces most happily, that is to say, upon having married them to men of fortunes far superior to their own. One niece still remained unmarried, Belinda Portman, of whom she was determined to get rid with all convenient expedition. Belinda was handsome, graceful, sprightly, and highly accomplished. Her aunt had endeavoured to teach her that a young lady's chief business is to please in society, that all her charms and accomplishments should be invariably subservient to one grand object, the establishing of herself in the world.
From the lyric feature, A Radical Life, a programme on the writer Maria Edgeworth, she would have loved the museum Isabel Conway wrote about in World Report, The Museum of Failed Love.
The couple hold hands and gaze at the axe used to chop up Annex's furniture. Helga points to the cell phone on display, labelled sadly, "He gave his to me so I couldn't call him anymore." Among the many diverse exhibits, including intimate memorabilia, is a book sitting behind perspex glass. Its title, I Can Make You Thin. A woman from England donated this blatant insult to her size she'd been sent by her ex-fiancé when they broke up.
Isabel Conway from World Report on Radio 1. That's it for this week, and thank you for all your suggestions to playback@rte.ie. I'll leave you with something from one of Marty Whelan's listeners on Marty in the Morning on Lyric FM.
Tim tells us that a spaceship landed in front of him. And out of it stepped a 20-foot cream bun. Apparently it was one of those extra cholesterols.